There's this big opportunity to build like audience in a box business. If you're big on any individual and any platform, you'll probably be big on other platforms as well. You just haven't gotten around to it yet. So if you have a big YouTube channel like Colin Samir do or a podcast, why wouldn't you also have a big newsletter? And if you can have support doing that, it's kind of a no-brainer to go to any creator who's big on any platform and say, hey, we'll help you get big on this other platform and give you a half of it. There's so many people who want to expand their audiences across platforms. A service that did this could charge quite a bit of money, or even co-incubate or co-own some of these media properties.
Hey, everybody, it's Eric Thornburg.
Dude, I'm honored. The roles are reversed.
Exactly. So for those of you who don't know, Eric, that's how Eric Thornburg, Mr. Podcast Man himself, network of podcasts, introduces, and it starts every show. So I had to put that in before you put it in.
I appreciate the tribute. Normally, I have the pleasure of interviewing you on one of my shows, but excited to come to yours today. Big fan.
I appreciate it, man. All right, we got a lot to discuss. You brought some heat, as expected. I want to start with the trends first, and then we'll dig into some of your startup ideas. So let's talk a little bit about, let's start with the rise of the B2B creator and what you're doing with Turpentine and why you think that's a trend worth, you know, betting your career on.
Yeah. So a few years ago during the pandemic, I started to watch what you were doing on Twitter. And I was like, huh, this is really interesting. And I tweeted out something like, there should be a Greg Eisenberg for X, where like people should study your playbook, go deep on a specific domain or sector, write or podcast about the space. And at the time you were, you know, obviously you remain going deep on consumer, on community, on audience building, on sort of, you know, the rise of creators. Go deep on a space, write or, you know, create media about the space, whether it's writing or podcasting, and then building, you know, products or tools that sell to people who engage with your content. And or investing, right? And so you were early to this trend. And people who were doing this in parallel with you were people like Lenny Wachitsky, right? For product managers, audience here, obviously extremely familiar, or Packy McCormick or Harry Stebbings. These people, including you, you know, Julian, people who come on your show, blew up the last few years. And so I saw that trend and said, hey, this is just the beginning. This there's going to be a lot more people like this. What Lenny is doing for product managers, that will exist for every position, for finance people, for engineering, for sales, marketing, et cetera. And that will also exist for every sector. And so I wanted to make a big bet on the emergence or the continued growth of niche creators, specific verticals, business verticals, and create media for those people. And instead of create the next TechCrunch for everything, create the next TechCrunch for a specific category. So I started Turpentine as a podcast network that basically, you know, today we are 13 podcasts, but instead of saying, hey, we're going to create the next Lex Fridman or Joe Rogan or, you know, hit show, it's hard to create hit shows from scratch today, but we're going to create the best show for CFOs or the best show for people in HR or the best show for people in AI. And, we've niched down and, we think that these niches are only going to get bigger, that the audiences are super valuable. And that this will be not only a valuable media business, but also just a valuable audience for me to incubate other products or invest in businesses that sell to those niche audiences. So that's what I'm up to with Turpentine is Greg Eisenberg for X, Lenny for X, starting with podcasts, but then expanding to other formats as well.
And why would you start with podcasts? Like to me, that seems painful given that I run a podcast and I know how hard it is to grow one. Why do you think it's worth investing as a podcast first? Like what am I missing there?
So podcasts are underrated for a few reasons. One is because they're the only media that you can create that allows you to create every other form of media from a podcast. So you create a podcast, you could turn that into a newsletter, you could turn that into a video, you could turn that into a community, right? Because you have all these guests who come on and you, boom, after 20 episodes of you know, having chief people officers, now you have this you know, incredibly valuable chief people officer community or a conference. So it's not that much hard work to get a podcast off the ground in a niche area and establish yourself, because there aren't, like, how many CFO podcasts are there? Not that many. How many chief people officer podcasts are there that are good? Not that many. We've created, just in the last few months, I think we have like a top three CFO podcast or chief people officer podcast. They don't have a ton of listeners. So, under 1,000 per episode, but they monetize really well, because people want to sell to that audience. And if you pair them with newsletters and you could build newsletters on top of the podcast, you could then monetize even better. But yeah, the punchline is they're the medium where you could build every other medium on top of. And if you go niche, you can create, pretty strong, ranking right out the gate.
So the other thing that people aren't talking about is that social networks are becoming more video oriented. So if you could own the search terms for CFO or how to create a balance sheet, and then people consume those videos and then they're like, okay, let me subscribe to this person or let me go buy his or her product. Like that's the other bet I think that you're making, because you're not really doing, when people hear podcast, they think audio, but it's really video first podcast, yes. Right?
Yes. Yes. And there's just a special relationship. You know, this is someone who hosts a podcast that you get from running a podcast that you don't get in the same way from other mediums, because there's audio, because there's video. And just to put some numbers on it, we're doing about 350,000 downloads a month across 13 shows, which is not huge. Like some shows, My First Million is bigger than all of our shows put together probably, but we're at about 2 million run rate probably, because the shows monetize pretty well. Like each show, we were talking earlier, like 30K a month or something like that. Like no show is huge, but it's kind of like the 80-20, where it's really hard to build a, mainstream podcast today, from a standing start, but to get to a show of 30K, 40K a month, in a strong niche, it's not that hard. And so if you can get a critical mass of them, you could start to build a real business. And then of course you could build all the other mediums on top of them. And one thing that people don't realize, as much is that when you look at media businesses of the last 15 years, one of the most valuable media businesses is this business called Industry Dive, which sold for $500 million to Informa. Today it'd probably be worth a lot more. And it was just a collection of trade publications like HR Dive, CFO Dive, basically what I'm trying to do with podcasts. And if you go to HR Dive or CFO Dive, it looks like it was made in 2012, because it was made in 2012. Like they haven't really innovated on the format. And so I've also been inspired by Workweek, which is a media business that's also trying to create the modern day Industry Dive. And they have more of a newsletter first approach. And that's also why I wanted to differentiate. But the value, there's been a lot of money poured into media businesses over the last 15 years. A lot of it has been poured into consumer media, because that's where the attention is. That's where the splashiness is. But business media, these are just great customer acquisition channels. And so in a world where, distribution is more and more important, acquisition is more important, it's easier and easier to build things. Owning those distribution channels, those acquisition channels, is just going to be increasingly more valuable. So that's why we're focused on what we're focused on.
So how do you think about choosing a new B2B niche? Because I think some people are going to be listening to this and be like, wow, like I want to do this, but I'm not sure if this niche actually is worth going after.
Yeah. So my first business out of college, which you'll remember, was a rap music business. It's called Rapt FM, and it was like a chat roulette for rap battles. So I was, really interested in rap and still am. And that was a niche I wanted to focus on, and there wasn't a ton of money there. there probably is much more today than there was back then, because niches are just bigger and bigger. But I mean, today in terms of how we pick our niche, we really focus on like who are enterprise buyers, like who do startups try to sell to, right? They try to sell to, finance people. They try to sell to salespeople. They try to sell to, CTOs. Like who are these just buyers at companies, HR leaders, right? And having invested in a lot of companies, I kind of get a sense for who startups are asking me to target. So part of it is enterprise buyers. Another part of it is just sectors that are important and that are hot and that aren't too crowded. like crypto is extremely crowded, or Web3 is extremely crowded. There's a very mature media ecosystem. And so we're not going in there at the moment. Whereas AI obviously is getting crowded. There, you know, our friend Ben Tossel created Ben's Bytes and other newsletters, but it's still really early. Like there isn't a sort of, you know, the equivalent of a Blockworks or a CoinDesk or a Cointelegraph, these kind of mature media companies for AI. Just yet, there are just a few newsletters that are taking off. And so we're actually deciding in Q1 to go much deeper on AI across platforms. So it's going to be our first newsletter. We're going to get into some news coverage as well, and really kind of going on that vertical. But historically, we've been looking at it. Hey, who are just customers that are really valuable? Are you enterprise buyers, or what are spaces that are really valuable? And then what are spaces that don't seem too crowded, where we think we could have a top five, you know, property within just a few months?
Have you thought about acquiring some creators in some creative way, or acquiring a business that has a creator attached to it? Like, for example, now I don't know if he's selling or would sell, but like Ben Tossel, you mentioned Ben Tossel, like his newsletter, Ben's Bytes. Like, what if you could acquire that business and then strap on the podcast as a part of it?
I haven't considered it seriously. Because we're in the business of ownership at the moment. The challenge of podcasts when you don't own the feed is that the host can just leave you. So we only want to be in business at the moment in places where we own the feed, because otherwise it's almost like investing in a startup. But once the startup gets a ton of traction, you don't own equity in it anymore. They just don't want to partner with you. And so we want to be, you know, co-owners for life. Otherwise, the incentives get misaligned and you have sort of this Taylor Swift or, you know, Scooter Braun-like situation. And then in order for us to acquire majority ownership, it just either would require a bunch of cash, which we're not immune to. We did put a bunch of cash to seed this business personally, but I just haven't seen the specific thing that we should go buy. But I'd love to hear your take. If you were me, how should I be thinking about acquisitions as a possible strategy?
Well, I think the interesting thing about owning something like Ben's Bytes, let's use that as the example, is, you know, you mentioned My First Million earlier. You know, My First Million wouldn't be where it is today, in my opinion, if it wasn't for its partnership with The Hustle.
Yeah.
And the way it worked was Sam and Sean came up with a brilliant idea for a podcast. They executed on it brilliantly and they were consistent. They did it, you know, every single week. And then they used the pipes, the media pipes of The Hustle to help promote some of those episodes, and still do that to this day. Actually, like the HubSpot network helped promote My First Million. Now you could say, well, Turpentine has all these shows, we'll just cross promote. And that's true. But if you wanted to go faster, and you know, one way would be to acquire media and then find, you know, either new talent or the founders like a Ben, to create a show.
Yeah. One thing we've been doing is trying to partner with the biggest hosts we can find. So basically in our network, we have Packy McCormick, we have Noah Smith and Bern Hobart, a few other kind of pretty big newsletter writers for their specific niches who have a few hundred thousand subscribers. And we say, hey, you don't have a podcast today. Let's create one for you. All you have to do is show up and talk about the things that you've been writing about regardless. And we'll give you 50% of everything in exchange for just, you know, an hour or so a week. And in exchange, they promote it in the newsletters too. So we are interested in partnering with people who already have distribution to borrow it. If there's an opportunity to acquire something where it makes sense, I'm really intrigued. I just worry about people's loss of motivation when they don't own it in the same way. Or I wonder if there's a way to get kind of the benefits of ongoing distribution by sort of co-creating with people who already have it in different formats, and then using those already existing user bases or distribution sets to bring them to the podcast and the collection of podcasts.
Do you know the story, the company behind Colin and Samir's newsletter? Have you heard about this?
Smooth Media. I think it the team from Morning Brew, that's very talented, that created a couple stars at Morning Brew and is now trying to do that for other creators as well, like pretty similar to what I'm doing.
Yes. Well, similar but different, you know? So Colin Samir have this newsletter. It's called the Published Press Newsletter. And it's a newsletter just for creators. Makes sense. Colin Samir, YouTubers who discuss creator stuff, create a newsletter. They want to get off the YouTube treadmill. So they have this newsletter. It now has like more than 100, 150,000 subs.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I started digging into it and I realized that it's a company called Smooth Media that's behind it. So basically they partner with creators and then they do email newsletters for them and they write them, etc. So it seems like a lot of people are scratching the surface on this B2B thing. I like your angle for podcasts first, because I think it's just harder. And sometimes when you do things that are harder, like there's more of a moat there. So I like what you're doing. There's another note that you have here on this list that says media businesses are under monetized. What do you mean by that?
First, let me just say, I think there's this big opportunity to build like audience in a box business. Like if you're big on any individual and any platform, you'll probably be big on other platforms as well. You just haven't gotten around to it yet. So if you have a big, YouTube channel like Colin Samir do or a podcast, like, yeah, why wouldn't the same, you know, why wouldn't you also have a big newsletter? And if you can have support doing that, it's kind of a no-brainer to go to any creator who's big on any platform and say, hey, we'll help you get big on this other platform and, you know, give you a half of it, but we'll keep half of it, right? And so there's so many people who want to expand their audiences across platforms. A service that did this could charge quite a bit of money or even co-incubate or co-own some of these media properties. Is there something like this that exists yet?
I mean, people are trying, right? Like, so Smooth is trying, you're trying, we're trying, you know, we're all kind of, we all have our own angle. And I think what you're seeing is that 2023, there was just like scratching the surface. 2024, I think we're going to see like, oh, turns out that podcasting was the right angle or community was the right angle or email newsletter was the right angle. So that's my prediction. By the end of 2024, I think we'll have a pretty good understanding of like how creators, and then specifically B2B creators, because I agree with you, B2B creators are, you know, are probably worth 100 times more. Like, you know, if you have 100,000 YouTube subscribers, you know, and as a B2B creator, that's like, you're basically the Mr. Beast of your world.
Yeah.
So that's totally my take on that.
Yeah. And so let me get to back to how media is under monetized. Well, it's interesting, right? We saw people like Harry Stebbings, Packy McCormick, built these large tech audiences and then raise funds on top of those audiences, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars in the case of Harry. What people say, A16Z, you know, it's like 50 billion or whatever AUM. They say it's a media company that monetizes via venture capital, right? So clearly investing is a compelling opportunity for people who are selling to business creators, at least in certain categories, right? But if you own this relationship with the customer, there's also additional things that you could be doing. Like maybe the next Harry Stebbings doesn't only do a venture capital sort of a fund, but maybe he also sells services to other venture capital firms. He has an agency, you know, that does fund management. Perhaps. Maybe he builds the underlying platform or builds, by builds, I mean, he's like an audience co-founder where someone trying to build the next Carta or AngelList or whatever, you know, platform that sells to his customer set where he has the sort of widest set of customers and the most trust with them, just to name Harry as an example and VC as one example position. But maybe they give him some percentage of the company for ongoing evangelism. So I think those are two ways in which it's directly under-monetized. But there's another way, which is there's a lot of data that media companies get as exhaust that they don't monetize. So I'll give one very specific example that was inspired by this business I saw called Tegas. Tegas is an expert marketplace. If you listen to Invest Like the Best, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, you've heard them advertise there. And so their expert marketplace like a Gerson Lerman Group, a GLG, which is sort of one of the early OG expert marketplaces. If you're looking to, let's say you're at a hedge fund and you're looking to make a biotech investment, and you're looking to talk to some customers or some people who used to work at this company or people who have expertise on this space, you'll ask GLG to set you up for a few calls. You'll pay some money for those calls. You as the expert will get paid to do those calls. It's kind of an established category. So what Tegas does is they go into this established category and they say, hey, we're going to record the calls. These calls are already happening. We're now going to record them. In exchange for recording them, we're going to take less of the sort of margin. So it's going to be cheaper. So it's cheaper for the person paying in order to use Tegas. As a result, these calls get recorded. They then build a database of these calls, a data set of these calls. And now if you're looking to learn, let's say, about biotech, instead of having to place an individual call, you can now read the transcripts of dozens of calls in the same amount of time. And so they've created a moat there just by using the exhaust from these calls that were already happening. Now, what do reporters or people in media do often is they get insights. They talk to people all the time, right? And so this insight came to me when I was reading this report on Stability AI that came out. It was on Forbes. It was a bit of a negative piece or expose. And this journalist talked to 30 reporters. Talked to 30 sources, early employees, executives, investors. And then I looked at Tegas. I was like, oh, wow, this reporter talked to 30 people. I looked at Tegas and they just had a handful of people on Stability AI. So I was like, wow, this journalist is maybe sitting on the best data set in the world, a qualitative data set in the world on Stability AI. Who else in the world knows what early employees, investors, whatever, et cetera, think about Stability? And the only revenue they're making is just the ad revenue off that Forbes piece. Whereas people on Tegas pay $25,000 per seat in order to access those calls. And the irony of those calls is if those calls were released to the broader public, they wouldn't be that popular. Like this information is extremely valuable to an extremely small set of people. And so people in the media businesses and media creators often don't price discriminate. And especially if you're in business media, if you can attract information that's extremely valuable to a very small subset of people, you should be charging a ton. And so media, especially journalists, they often have this broad sense of informing the public and they kind of think the public is equal. But if you're reporting on business, maybe your customer shouldn't be the person outside of tech who's just trying to understand what's happening, but maybe you should be informing an investor on, or your data set should be informing an investor on, hey, should I invest in Stability AI? Should I join Stability AI? And so most people who create media don't think who is the most valuable customer I should sell this to and what is the actual job to be done here or value prop that I could sell them that I could thus charge a lot more perhaps. So that's a way in which we think media is under-monetized and in which we are going to try to do ourselves. So we are going to create media that helps people do better at their job and identify which companies are doing well, et cetera. We're going to get in the list game, right? Top companies, top people per sector, use this media to get all this insights, all this data on people and companies and products, and then try to sell that data, in a transparent way. People know, what they're signing up for, there's anonymity, et cetera, but to the most valuable, the sort of customer that values it the most. So that was a input on why I think media is under monetized because they're not just providing eyeballs; they're also providing data, insights, and sometimes even determining reputation, and that is very valuable.
It's almost like the eyeballs are like the least interesting part.
Yes, exactly. That's well said. Like if you owned the information, just as or Forbes or something, and we're not constrained by sort of the idea of being a journalist, which also interestingly today, people aren't constrained, right? The Lennies, the Yous, the Packies, you guys could invest in the businesses that you cover. You could incubate businesses and people don't trust you any less for it. So that's an interesting development, but let's say you're getting rid of the information. what other businesses could you create on top of that, right? They used to do org charts, right? It's almost like Craigslist, right? Like, remember the same Craigslist graph where you looked at every sort of feature on Craigslist and saw, oh, that's Airbnb, that's this kind of business, that's another business. Similarly, like if we go in the information, I see they have org charts. Oh, wait, there's a company called The Org that just specialized in that. They have like a different professional network. I'm like, oh, wait, okay, there's LinkedIn. Like you can imagine building a professional network off of that. There's, all these data companies. There's Crunchbase that just kind of, Crunchbase emerged from TechCrunch, right? So there's Glassdoor, you could imagine. Like media companies, and there are other things that are like this too. Recruiters, what do they do all day? They get all this data on people. One business I want to build is reference checks as a service, right? We do all these reference checks, and yet no one ever compiles them or organizes them. And anytime there's a sort of a thing that is done all the time that's not recorded, that could have data as exhaust, I'm interested in, hey, could you create something that structures that data that has like a give to get model, where people are incentivized to give data in order to see the data, and building these kind of like information marketplaces, and we're using media as the wedge.
So what you're saying is similar to how there was the unbundling of Craigslist, and I've talked about the unbundling of Reddit.
Yes.
Basically taking a subreddit, a niche, a subreddit niche, and then people building products for that.
Yes.
For that niche. There's this new B2B media unbundling that's happening. And you have the ability to build social networks, you have the ability to build marketplaces, you have the ability to build agencies, you have the ability to build SaaS tools. And the media is just almost like the ticket to the ride.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I've watched you and the businesses you've been able to build, the different agencies, the different communities, the different products, and a lot of it stemmed from your Twitter, and then your newsletter and the other stuff you've built. And I think I've realized, hey, like I enjoy creating, but I don't think I'm the world's best creator. I don't think I'm as good as you are. But I think what I could do is find the Greg Eisenberg for X and help produce them or help incubate them. And some people listening to this have that creator drive or that potential. And some say, hey, maybe they're more of a producer or maybe they're more of a partner to these creators. I think one thing that's underexplored also, there's this massive creator. I don't want to burst a spot in case it's confidential, but at the level of someone like yourself who has a chief of staff who gets 25% of everything he does. And I think that's a really interesting model for someone who realizes, hey, I'm not the creator, I'm the producer. I'm the person who's gonna let the creator just be themselves and I'm gonna take care of everything else. Go up to someone you really admire and say, hey, I'll do literally take everything off your plate that you don't like doing that's really important, gonna get you to the next level. Give me some percentage of what you make, 10%, 20%, 25%, whatever it is. I feel like that's an opportunity for people. So, and that's what we're doing at Turbo Time. We get 50%. Right. And so, yeah, that's how we think about it.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I really like the producer versus creator bit. I'm gonna use that. I'll credit you on that. Not everyone needs to be a creator.
Yeah.
Not everyone needs to be a creator. Back when like being an entrepreneur was really cool and everyone wanted to be an entrepreneur, people used, some people that I really respect would say, not everyone needs to be an entrepreneur. And now 2024, it's like, no, not everyone needs to be a creator. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the producers actually do way better than the creators in the end. Wouldn't be surprised just because they're more diversified. They can produce multiple projects. They learn, like you're going to learn so much about, what's working, what's not working across your portfolio. We see that ourselves. Like we have a portfolio and we're doing an offsite in Miami next week with all the different leads of all the different businesses. And they're going to all share what's working and what's not working.
Yeah.
And as, the producer, you can look at that and be like, okay, maybe we shouldn't have incubated that AI business, but let's go incubate something like this.
Totally. Yeah. And it's interesting. Like if we're doing for podcasts now, what Smooth Media is doing for newsletters, some people are doing for YouTube. If you own a medium, you get really good at any specific medium, you can then go to people. Of course you can do it for service and get paid. But if you're good enough, you can co-incubate. You can go to someone who doesn't have one of these channels and say, hey, what Smooth Media is doing, say, hey, we'll create this for you. We'll run the whole thing. We own 50% and want to be long-term partners or whatever we own and are long-term partners. And I think that's just a difference in mindset. It requires taking a bit more upfront risk, but if they're already big on a different medium, you know, you've kind of diversified. And one example I'll give, and this guy's been immensely successful, so I don't mean to take anything from him, but Dave Perel, you know, he did his writing courses. I think another business he could have done, now he's not as passionate about it, so, you know, he should do what he's passionate about. He's been very successful, but he could have, instead of teaching people how to write, he could have gone to people who either, you know, are big on other platforms or just have really valuable service businesses like, you know, financial wealth managers or accountants or lawyers or whatever, and said, hey, I'm going to make you the biggest lawyer on Twitter or the biggest accountant on Twitter, the biggest whatever. And in exchange, make me a 25% partner in your business. And he could have done that with like 5 or 10 accounts or more, and really just been in kind of the equity game. And it's a shift in mindset from teach someone how to do something to kind of do it for them in exchange for a big chunk. Now, if you do that, you can work with, there are trade-offs, of course. You can only work with there's much limited number of people you can work with because it takes much more time. Whereas, of course, you can, you know, serve sort of, you know, infinite people in theory in terms of however, if it's asynchronous, at least in terms of how many people watch it. But you then get in the ownership game. And I'm very excited about the ownership game.
How much have you studied music, the music business?
A little bit. Wrapped FM was in the music business. I mean, labels were amazing at sort of these 360 at owning their artists. And I have a friend who worked at this company called United Masters, which tried to reinvent record contracts to look more like venture deal, to look more like situations where the entrepreneurs owned the most of the company instead of the VC or instead of the record label in the case of music. And one finding he had was, although I don't know how widespread this is or still today, is that most artists or at least rappers actually preferred the deals that the record labels gave them because they got more money up front. And they were able to do anything they wanted with that money. And I think that's a little bit different between record labels and VC. Like if you get a few million dollars from a VC, I think it's less expected that you're able to just like pay yourself that. I think in fact, they encourage you to not pay yourself much. I know people who raise 5 million in VC paying themselves 50K salary. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, they pay themselves, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Why don't you pay yourself anything? But I guess artists just were more comfortable paying themselves a lot of their advance. And so they preferred the 1 million up front and giving up 90% of everything they ever make than ever. I mean, of course many of them regret it later on. Anyways, I'm rambling a bit. So that's my familiarity with the industry.
So VC and music and the music business have a lot in common. Essentially they put up money and they're producers, put another way, they're producers in your words, and they get some upside. You know, a lot of people, including Kanye West, say some things about music labels that, you know, they own their artists. Yeah. And so I think that's not great.
Which is why I want to be in co-ownership. I want to be, right. Hey, let's be partners.
I think it needs to be partners, right? Yeah. In the truest sense. And to defend the music labels a little bit, like, I'm sure not all of their deals are like that. Really, yeah. You know, but yeah, you know, I think what you're trying to do is feels to me very much like a music label co-ownership partnership style, where you're essentially approaching a B2B creator and you're saying, hey, like, let me go accelerate this for you. And let's go, you know, put 1 + 1 = 3 here. And you know, there might be some, you know, advance of some sort. I'll get you advertisers. I'll do this. I'll do that. I'll help build. And I think the takeaway for the listener, one of the takeaways is like, don't be afraid to approach creators and be like, hey, I want to produce. And in fact, the opportunity in 2024 is the approaching and the producing in a lot of ways.
Totally. And it's interesting because any creator who has an audience on one platform probably wishes that they could have an audience on another platform. And if you're good at that other platform, they've already de-risked it a little bit by having an audience and showing product market fit on one platform. So going to them and saying, hey, let's create this on this other platform. You know, Packy has a big newsletter. Go to Packy. Hey, let's reach the same audience via podcast. He says, yes, no brainer. But here's an interesting thing. Like, we did that in AI, for example, with an AI creator. And now we want to create an AI newsletter. And we actually don't need the creator anymore because we co-own the podcast. We're going to create, he could create a newsletter too. He can create, meaning he can leverage the work we did on the podcast to help him in any other thing he wants to do in the future. But similarly, I guess what I'm saying is we're borrowing or using the creator for their distribution, but of course providing a ton of value, giving them more distribution, more revenue, something they wouldn't have had otherwise. But now because we've sort of, you know, established one format, we can go in another format and then create our own owned sort of audience, say, hey, we're going to do it 100% ourselves. And this is how we're building our brand. We're building the brand off, you know, great partnerships with creators that we then go into other platforms and say, hey, now this is the Turpentine AI newsletter. And yeah, we'll promote the podcast. So he's happy to, and promote his stuff, et cetera. But, if you're a producer and or even a creator and don't have an audience, partnering with a creator in one format to help you get out there, right? We have his friend Safwan, who's an up and comer, who partnered with Michael Carnes to create a podcast. And I think the value exchange was that he did a lot of the work for it. They get seen as co-hosts, that grows Safwan's audience. Now Safwan can use that for other things. But yeah, being able to add value to other creators helps you build your audience that then you can use for other things is the takeaway.
I like it, man. I like it. So, is there room for all of us?
I think so. I mean, you identified early on that these niches are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's interesting, right? Like, because venture capitalists have raised more and more money, the expectations of what they need for returns are much higher, right? So, it used to be like $1 billion business. That was like venture scale. Then it's like $10 billion business. You know, at some point it's going to be $100 billion business, right? And so a lifestyle business is just a business that's not appropriate for a venture. And so as the venture expectations have gotten bigger, because all this money flooded the ecosystem, these the what people call lifestyle business is much bigger. Like, if it can only, you know, make $100 million in revenue, maybe it's a lifestyle business for some VCs, right? But that's massively life changing, you know. And so these niches are getting bigger, and also these areas where VCs aren't touching, you know, as much are getting wider, which means there's less competition, perhaps, there's I mean, you called it a few years ago. Any subreddit where there's just a growing community, there's probably a big business waiting to be built there. And if you see a creator in one format, perhaps you can help that creator get to the next format. Maybe become the creator yourself, or become the entity that produces a bunch of creators. But it still feels very early innings, particularly in business. Creators, we're looking to talk to, you know, anyone who's creating something for a certain sector or for a certain valuable business audience, feels like it's just the beginning.
The short answer is yes. There's room for not just only us, but really, like, there's thousands of business ideas, tens of thousands of business ideas for creators out there. B2B is interesting. You know, we're also really focused there. There are some opportunities in B2C, but my take on this is, and I'll tell you a little story, I haven't shared this publicly, but my take is basically that the top 50 creators in B2C are uninteresting to collaborate with. Mm-hmm. And we had a creator, top YouTube creator, and when I say top, I mean top 10. Wow. Top 12 YouTube creator come to us. We had his trust, wanted to collaborate and wanted to co-incubate something. And we walked away from it. And we walked away from it because, you know, that particular, I'm trying not to give it away, but basically, like, it was funny type videos. And there wasn't a niche there. There wasn't a strong niche. It was just like, people would watch it when they just wanted time to pass. They weren't really, really connected to that particular creator. So I think those creators are not that interesting. But there are consumer creators who have a niche that the audience has disposable income that you could produce with.
Yeah, totally. But one thing I just find so interesting as an aside, Greg, is like, you're not someone who came up as a 22-year-old thinking about kind of this new greenfield of niche ideas. You're someone who kind of did it the old way and built a lot of cred in the old world, so to speak, of, you know, raising a ton of venture money, having worked for a venture, you know, backed company, or the biggest one in WeWork. And there were so many incentives to just keep going down that path in some ways. And there's a lot to walk away from in terms of, I'm sure some people came up to you and were like, hey, what are you doing? Like, you know, that feels weird. Like, it's the golden era of raising VC, and you're saying, hey, don't raise VC. And so it's so much harder when you have stuff to walk away from. And that's why I used to say things like, it was easier to get into crypto if like you came up in it or something, because you didn't have all these people saying, oh, that's weird, but you did. And I think that's inspiration for people who are already down a path, who either, you know, raised a bunch of money or are in a space that doesn't feel that exciting, or it doesn't feel like you're on the sort of, you know, what's going to happen. If you're listening to this, you kind of have a vibe for where things are going and what types of people are going to have more and more career capital. And it's the Yu's, it's the Sahil Blooms, it's the, you know, Sean Puri's, et cetera. And so I just hope that is inspiration for people listening, that, you can take that different path, even if you're already down a path. And if you know, if people are thinking that, hey, the path is weird, maybe you're doing something right, or you know, maybe you're onto something because you're exploring something that is on the upswing or that people haven't figured out yet. And so that's both an opportunity for people who are just up and comers and getting their start to explore something that's underexplored. But on the up and cup, but also people who've been in the game for a while.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. The reason I had this come to Jesus moment was because I saw how the sausage was made. And once I saw how the sausage was made, I realized that this not only, it just wasn't for me. It just was not for me. You know, you talked earlier about how sometimes founders don't pay themselves after even raising millions of dollars. And that's really true and not really spoken about. When I was running Islands, I paid myself a $75,000 salary in San Francisco, which like goes nowhere.
Nothing.
And in the last 12 months, I didn't even feel like I deserved a salary because I wanted to extend the runway. So I stopped taking a salary. So there's so many examples of venture-backed startups and where that can go. And I'm happy that more and more people are sharing it. And that's one of the reasons why I like the podcast, is it gives me an opportunity to share these stories. And yeah, like I could have gone, I was at WeWork close with the SoftBank folks. Like I could have just gone and been a partner or whatever at SoftBank for the rest of my life and sold money to people. But no. And I honestly, like, I find this path to be, for me at least, way more interesting. I don't know about you. Like, how are you? You also have a background in venture, raised a lot of money. How do you feel about this new kind of rogue path that we're on?
It's been an adjustment. So raised a lot of money in the past from a lot of the big names. And when you raise money from big names, you get invited to fancy parties and people come up to you and just give you all this validation all the time. And people, you know, venture capital firms became so good at marketing where they convinced founders to take a lot of their money, more money than they ever needed. Right. I remember at Product Hunt, we raised a seed round. We had like $2 million or something, maybe $1.5 or $2 million in the seed round. And then a few weeks later, we got a Series A term sheet from Andreessen Horowitz. And we didn't even know how to spend the $2 million, let alone the 8 to 10 that came after it. But it was, and I love, I'm friends with that firm, but that money was just so enticing. And you know, did we need the money? Not really, right? Was that the right thing for the business? Unclear. But the firm and just VC in general is so good at being a signal to the market that our company is one to be taken seriously, and people should want to join our company. People should want to trust, customers should want to trust that. And so it's incumbent on startups, in a startup ecosystem to have other versions. This is why I'm excited about media too. Other versions of that signal, other versions of that blessing that don't come with major dilution, overly capitalized businesses, and expectations that are way ahead of where the business is going. And there needs to be other entities that can bless these companies with that signal that don't come with the same sort of constraints. So you ask me how it's going. It's been an adjustment because I haven't been invited to all the same fancy parties, or I haven't had the same level of validation. People say, oh, what are you up to? I say, oh, you know, I'm working on this media company. Oh, that's cute. You know, it's, but when are you going to go for something really big? And I'm like, oh no, wait, this is like the infrastructure. One, this is big, but two, this is the infrastructure. And I didn't raise any venture for it. And people just think you're going small, right? But people don't realize like the MailChimps and, you know, Zapier, there's a lot of businesses, or there's at least enough businesses that have gotten massive, massive scale that barely raised any venture money or didn't raise any at all. And venture capitalists would have loved to put money in the same way that there's, you know, lifestyle business is kind of this like euphemism. There should be a similar euphemism for a business that's like too good to raise venture money, right? It, like the MailChimps or Zapier is like venture capitalists would die to put money into it, but it's too good of a business. It doesn't need this upfront, like, you know, massive capital and dilution and expectations and bosses, as you've been, you know, writing about how you investors, you've got bosses. And I have a friend who got his business to $30 million a year ARR, totally bootstrapped. It's a service business. He did just raise some money because he wants to go really big on AI, and that's great for him. But you know, it's easier to get businesses off the ground. It's easier to get distribution, and if you don't need capital for it, why raise it? So it's a bit of adjustment. But I think what you and I and other people are doing are showing examples of success, like businesses that achieve real success that didn't need to raise money, that were in fact sort of advantaged for not raising money. And I have it's increasingly in the same way that a lot of our friends want to do personal holding companies, which we will get to in a minute. But a bunch of our friends who've raised hundreds of millions or even more in capital say, "Hey, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to do that anymore. I want to raise zero." And now it's like we need to turn it from a sign that you couldn't raise money to a sign that you're too good to raise money. Like you know the costs of it, and you don't need it anymore.
Well, let's just change the name of
exactly
of unicorns, unicorn founders, and unicorn companies to, like, a unicorn company isn't something that gets to $1 billion valuation. It's something that gets to $1 billion value. You know, right. If you can get, it's something that gets to like 10 million in cash flow. That to me is a unicorn company.
Yeah.
And a unicorn founder is someone who could do that. It's like your buddy.
Yeah. No, totally. It's crazy. I'm making my goals for 2024. And when I look back at my goals for previous years, it was like, okay, get this, you know, my company to 20 million in revenue and to this growth percentage. But like, those were the wrong metrics. Like those metrics were based on what investors wanted. Right. They wanted to see a graph up and to the right of revenue, but that didn't take costs into account, right? Or growth, but that didn't take retention into account, right? And so now I'm thinking about, hey, these are goals just for me. And it's like, wait, what exactly should the goals be? It's just like a totally different way of thinking about business building when you're your own boss, as opposed to your investors. And your investors just have a different level of risk reward, given they're, you know, extremely diversified and, you know, playing lottery tickets.
So can you talk a little bit more about what your goals are for 2024?
Yeah, I'm creating them right now, but I want Turpentine to, I want $1 million in my bank account as a result of, you know, next year, Turpentine. Yeah. So it's less of a revenue number for the company and more of, you know, what I take personally. But I'm also going to keep reinvesting into the business. So I want us to get, so I have a distribution goal as well. I want us to hit 1 million monthly podcast listens. We're at 350 right now. I also want have a newsletter goal as well. I'm still figuring out what's the right number. We're at zero today, but I want us to go big on newsletters. But there are a couple other things I want us to get into as well. I want us to get into the reputation game. I think lists are very powerful if done well. And I want to really establish ourselves in the list game. And then I also want to start this expert network. And I want to create this flywheel between this sort of the reporting that the media company does and that data entering this sort of expert network or the transcripts. Each call should be a transcript that enters this database that is compounding. I also have a few other reputation products. I've just launched. One is a VC rating system. One is a service provider rating system. One is a SaaS tool rating system or review site. One is a company review site. I'm going to have individual metrics for or company reviews, yeah, like a Glassdoor competitor, individual metrics for those. And those are going to be part of this Bookface competitor that I'm launching, this sort of social network for founders. So high level intention for 2024, it's build the infrastructure that is going to help me create more businesses and, you know, have more kind of ability to invest or like get into deals that I'm excited about by just having more leverage. Like I saw how Product Hunt and OnDeck just gave me so much leverage because people wanted me to in their network or on the cap table because I can get them distribution and I can get them talent. And I want to create those same sort of bulwarks in the broader empire I'm building on the distribution side. And part of distribution is also reputation, but then also on and then also on the talent side. And so there's going to be a, you know, tangible sort of distribution, you know, audience size and, you know, profit numbers related to that, but also this broader sense of, hey, you know, am I building the infrastructure that makes it easier for me to incubate more businesses on top of that? So that's how I'm thinking about 2024.
I like it. I like it. Big year. We only got a few minutes left. I want you to give folks a few free startup ideas or things they should be thinking about. What do you got?
Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned that I'm really excited about reputation. One idea I have is Quora for people, basically a search engine for X, you know, who's the X for Y. I'm in, you know, who's the best dentist in Miami or who's the best fintech investor, or I'm going to New York. Who should I meet? We see these questions on Twitter all the time or Facebook. They have tons of engagement and then they're never stored. And so I'm really interested in the intersection of engagement and kind of like state, you know, stored state. And so you could go on Twitter and scrape all these questions, or you know, you use LLMs to somehow find a lot of these questions, organize them, structure them, create your own social network just for these, questions. And then find, you know, who to sell them to, because it, similarly to what I said earlier, it's not like some of this information is really valuable to a small subset of people. So that's a space I'm curious to explore. Speaking of things that are really valuable to a small subset of people, the dating space. I think people are going around at the wrong way. They're not price discriminating. I think, you know, if we were to ask single people, how much would you pay of your, what percentage of your net worth would you pay to find your partner in the next year or two, especially people in their 30s, right? I think it's fair to say that a bunch of people would say something like 10%, 20%, maybe even more. And so I think there is a big opportunity to build sort of a high-end combination coaching plus matchmaking business, almost of like what an executive recruiter does. So we paid, you know, 100K plus to get a COO or to get a CFO. And that recruiting firm didn't just source for us. They took us through the whole process and made sure we found one. It's like, yeah, you could find a CFO on your own, but if you pay 100K, you're definitely going to get one. And they're going to stay with you until you get one. And I think something similar on the matchmaking front. And I've only seen solutions that do either matchmaking or do coaching, but not like personal trainer style, like just make sure it's, you know, do it for you almost, like be in the dating apps for you. And I think
in general, for you.
Yeah, exactly. I think in general, it's a big trend of like shifting from like teach you how to do something to like press button and it's done, like do it for you. And this sort of like going from coaching to personal trainer doesn't just tell you what to do. He also like, or she watches you until you do it. And I, you know, I like solutions that do that. For people, because there's all this education and it's great, but it's rare to have, you know, someone who will take the whole end. And I think there's something at the intersection of like, and you've thought about this too in different ways, but coaching, accountability, sort of, you know, executive assistant, that just kind of is there with you, a personal trainer for life, basically. What are the areas in which you want to grow? Like I looked at my 2024 goals, and one thing I'm doing, and I'm lucky enough to have some people helping me, but hey, EAs are cheap. You use Athena and get a, you know, pay, you know, a few bucks an hour, I mean, $6 an hour for an assistant. And you can get someone to help you out too. And I'm putting that assistant next to those goals. Like imagine having someone whose job it is to achieve your goals for you. like the level of not just accountability, but support that you will get from that is really powerful. So I'd love a service that takes that to the next level. Maybe that just is Athena, but you can imagine it applied to different spaces like relationships as an example.
Yeah. And I don't think it's Athena. Like, I don't think it, you know, cause it needs to be purpose built for right. this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
All right, man. Idea machine. I like it. I also like that the underlying theme of this whole conversation has been price discrimination.
Yeah,
and totally. It's like, how do you sell the most expensive thing to a small group of people?
Yeah.
And start there. It doesn't mean you can't democratize it and build totally. Something for everyone.
Tiers, yeah.
Tiers. But so I like that. I like that. Where could people get to know you more?
Twitter. Check out, I'm Eric Tornberg on Twitter. I have Substack, Turpentine.co. If you want to check out what we're doing, if you loved any of the ideas that I'm working on, I see myself as wanting to build a studio and incubator. So do reach out if you're inspired to take on any of the ideas and just want support or want a potential partner on it.
You got to come back on again, man.
Amazing. Like it. Yeah. All it's right. been an honor to be here, Greg. Always love chatting with you and brainstorming. We got to do our next Pura Vida.
Yes, absolutely. You left Miami. I can't believe you left Miami.
I know. It was hard, but I'll come back and visit.
Was it because there was just Tornberg, Eisenberg, you were getting mixed up? You know, you can.
Yeah, I didn't know there was enough Bergs. Yeah. Enough Berg energy. No, it was a good run, but there was a moment where I just needed more professional and personal serendipity in my life.
Yes.
And so I came back.
So end with this. San Francisco, how is it versus like our San Francisco 2012, 2019?
Wasn't the same, you know, but it's not the same, but it's back. It's you know, people have left. There's a whole new, a lot of people, like we came up with Ryan Hoover, like he's gone. Like David Spinks, he's gone. Like a bunch of people, right? A bunch of people are friends, they're gone. But there's a whole new crop. A whole new, you know, set of young people who came in, and one thing that's different is there's a sort of consciousness to San Francisco about sort of making San Francisco great, which is like making it a safe place, like getting there are people who are now like running for office who were previously doing tech companies, and that's exciting to me because one of the things that I sort of miss about Miami or didn't like about San Francisco was it felt that everything was just about tech and there wasn't really enough diversity. And now I'm seeing all this kind of like community activism energy. And it's just giving a new flair, a new excitement. And it makes me feel like part of something bigger than just myself or just my company. It's like, no, let's actually like make this city great.
If you're in your 20s and you want to start a Turpentine or late checkout type business, do you do San Francisco, New York, or somewhere else?
I think the answer used to be, you had to be in San Francisco if you were trying to build a tech company. Now I think you can probably be anywhere. But you know, I still think on the margins, probably San Francisco or New York or just wherever there's a concentration of, you know, amazing people, like wherever you can find your tribe, that's where you should go. Like in San Francisco, when I first moved here, I couldn't find my tribe for a couple of years. So it wasn't a great place for me. So I'd almost like find them online. Like see where people you want to meet, where do they live? People you can meet too. And then just go there. Like if you're able to get into the Austin scene with Dave Perrell and Justin Maris and all these people, like go to Austin, right? That's how I would think about it. It's like, where can you find your tribe and look online first?
Or if you want to come hang out with me and Ryan Hoover in Miami.
Yes, exactly.
Come do that. So I won't take it personally. Appreciate the time. Later.
Yeah. Appreciate it, bud.